We're going to call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. This is Tuesday, the 15th. We have four bills at this point that are set for public hearing and possible work sessions. And at this point, I'd like to check in with Ms. Braun if there's anything we need to go over before we do the first bill.
Nope, we can go right into it.
All right, we're going to pull public hearing, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 433, and we'll be getting our list of requested testimonies. And let's see, Bob Russell. Mr. Russell, would you please come up? Oh.
Well, no, he can come up. This is, we're trying to make this work.
Bob, come on up. Ms. Braun, tell me. I know you did. Y'all are working together, conspiracy. I know. All right, it's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 433 clarifies that truck owner operators are non-subject workers for workers' compensation purposes.
Thank you. Mr. Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. The trucking industry has long used independent contractors, which we refer to as owner-operators. However, in Oregon, there's a great deal of confusion of whether or not these folks are subject workers for workers' compensation purposes. In virtually all situations, our owner-operators meet the definition of independent contractor for federal income tax withholding, for state income tax withholding, and for unemployment insurance. However, a number of them are considered to be subject workers for workers' compensation purposes. Safe and Liberty have what is called the 25% rule. They take 25% of the compensation to the owner-operator and call that wages, and workers' compensation premiums are paid based on the 25%. The balance, 75% of their compensation, is considered rent of the vehicle, insurance, fuel, those kinds of things. Although Safe and Liberty consider owner-operators to be independent contractors, not all insurance companies that provide workers' comp insurance in Oregon do, which creates a real inequity. It's not universally known among the trucking industry that some insurance companies do view owner-operators as independent contractors and some don't. Often, if they're Safe or Liberty customers, the first time they realize that their owner-operators are, in fact, subject workers for workers' comp is when the auditor shows up at the door. You may recall during the ballot measure this last fall on Safe, there was a commercial, and there was a lady by the name of Jan Schmidt, and it said, "Safe put my trucking company out of business." Well, what the commercial didn't say was that the issue was that she used owner-operators or independent contractors. And she discovered at time of audit that, in fact, these folks were subject to workers' compensation. Many of the larger trucking companies are self-insured for workers' comp. I did an informal survey of my members, and some of them realize that their owner-operators are subject workers, and some of them don't. So, again, we've got a real inequity and unlevel playing field. To sort of exacerbate the situation, current law, and if you look at the bill, on the third page, it starts, the second line, there's an exemption or what's non-subject workers. The person who has an ownership or leasehold interest in equipment and who furnishes, maintains, and operates the equipment. As used in this section, equipment means a motor vehicle used in the transportation of logs, poles, or piling. A motor vehicle used in the transportation of rocks, gravel, sand, dirt, and asphalt, and concrete, which are dump trucks. So basically, by current law, dump trucks and log trucks already, if it's an owner-operator situation, they are non-subject workers. What I'm asking for is that we add another subsection to that section and include owner-operators that work for hire motor carriers that are required to possess a certificate or a permit issued by the Department of Transportation. That wording is very important. We wanted to make sure that there weren't any unintended consequences. In working with the department, they were concerned that if the wording were too broad, we might pull in pizza delivery folks or somebody taking a bank deposit to the bank or the mail to the post office. By specifying that it's a for-hire motor carrier that's required to obtain a certificate or permit, those people are not included in this bill. So those folks would continue to be subject workers. On January 6th, MLAC unanimously approved this concept, and I would ask that you move the bill forward. That concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Moreno.
Thank you. Is there a statutory definition of what a for-hire motor carrier is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, yes, there is. Those words were carefully chosen because they're all defined in the motor carrier regulatory law. The term for-hire motor carrier, the term property.
Does the word for-hire, is that the same thing as owner-operator?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, no. A for-hire motor carrier is one that holds themselves out to the general public to provide transportation services. That's paraphrasing, but that's generally the definition. So an owner-operator, the ones that I'm talking about, would be leased to a for-hire motor carrier.
I see.
But they're still independent contractors.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo, go ahead.
My brain's just not working fast enough. I'm sorry.
I'm going to just jump in real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
The question you asked about for-hire, word and phrases, it's under 825. I think you got this over 825.005.
Okay.
I think it would be worth us putting that on the record. And if you don't feel like speaking too much, yeah. I think counsel should be more than glad to.
I can manage this one, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe I can't. This is 825.005 sub 7. For-hire carrier means, and then there's a sub A and a sub B. Sub A says any person who transports persons or property for hire or who publicly purports to be willing to transport persons or property for hire by a motor vehicle. And then or sub B, any person who leases, rents, or otherwise provides a motor vehicle to the public and who in connection therewith in the regular course of business provides, procures, or arranges for directly or indirectly or by course of dealing a driver or operator therefore.
There's my,
But just to follow up, it says, okay, let's focus on the sub A. Any person who transports persons or property for hire, I'm trying to distinguish this from, say, an employee. Let's say you've got Joe's Trucking Company. How do I know that that person doesn't fit within this definition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, if you look at the top, starting with line 2 on page 3 of the bill, first of all, a person who has an ownership or leasehold interest in the equipment and who furnishes, maintains, and operates the equipment.
I see. Okay.
That's a very different animal than an employee.
I see. That's right.
Anything else, Senator Ringo? We can come back to you if you want.
Yeah, well, I guess the... let's go to Senator Burdick. Thank you.
I have a far less erudite question, and that is, for the people who aren't covered by the workers, who aren't regarded as covered workers, if they get injured on the job, is it up to their private insurance, or do they cover themselves, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, there's basically two different options that are commonly used in other states and some that are used in this state at the present time, quite frankly. One is an if-any policy. So basically you're buying a policy, and it's less expensive than the normal workers' comp policy. In the event that there is an accident or an injury, then it converts to workers' comp. And the other is occupational accident insurance, which covers the worker during the time that they're working. In some instances, not in all, but in some instances, those policies also convert to a workers' comp policy if there's a workers' comp claim filed and accepted.
Chair, follow up. If someone files a workers' comp claim, then they don't have, if the employer is negligent, for example, they don't have a remedy against the employer. Is that correct? Unless they're, if the employer is negligent, they have protection if there's workers' comp coverage. Is that correct?
Not my area of law.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I'm not a lawyer. but I think, I know. I think you're making a distinction. If there's negligence, I think that there's tortious liability on the part of the employer. I think.
What was your question again?
My question was, it's my understanding that under workers' comp insurance, what the employer gets out of it is they are not liable if someone gets injured on the job, that that's an exclusive remedy. Workers' comp is an exclusive remedy.
Right.
So my question to you is, for these people who aren't covered, is it, if they have alternative insurance, is that an exclusive remedy, or can the person collect under that and then go back after the employer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the reason that these policies convert to workers' comp is that if they go after the employer, using your words, and the claim is accepted, then that turns into workers' comp, so then you have the same provisions.
Is there an exclusive remedy in that scenario?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else?
No.
Back to Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Are there examples where owner-operators will work for the same trucking company a year on end, and they're an owner-operator, and yet it's that company decides where they're going to go, what they're going to pick up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I think you've hit at the heart of the matter. As Bob Shipwreck often says, when we talk about independent contractors, there's all these businesses over here, and then there's trucking. And we are just a unique animal for a whole bunch of reasons. And one of them, you're absolutely correct, an owner-operator will often lease to a particular motor carrier and will continue to work for that motor carrier for an extensive period of time. They can terminate their lease and they can go down the road to lease onto somebody else. But if they're happy, they're going to stay. And in terms of direction and control, there's a couple of issues. One certainly is we dispatch the motor vehicle. We tell them where to go pick up the shipment, where to deliver the shipment. So there is that element of direction and control. It's not that you tell the owner-operator to go out and do business. You're telling them exactly what to do. There's another little piece, and that is that we are a heavily regulated industry. So when an owner-operator leases to a motor carrier, that motor carrier becomes responsible to administer the federal motor carrier safety regulations that apply to that owner-operator, hours of service, those kinds of things. So that does confuse the traditional definition of independent contractor. Although, as I mentioned earlier in my testimony today, our owner-operators clearly qualify as independent contractors for federal withholding, state income tax withholding, and unemployment insurance. It's just the workers' comp piece where you've got a definition of independent contractor, but you've also got this non-subject worker thing. It works best for us the way we've written this, where it's clearly a non-subject worker. There's no issue. As you've seen from looking at Chapter 825, the terms are well-defined. There's no ambiguity.
Okay. Just one more, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Sorry.
It's your voice, not ours.
You have to listen to it. You said Safe and Liberty are handling this right now by saying that independent operators are not covered workers' comp employees.
Mr. Chairman, it's the opposite. They are. if an owner-operator leases on to a trucking company, and it's the 20, that they use the 25% rule, where 25% of the compensation is considered wages, and premiums are assessed on that basis.
I see. And so how many drivers out there? How many how many owner-operators are out there who this will impact?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, nobody quite knows the answer to that. There isn't a database of owner-operators. In working with the department and as we went through the MLAC process, which, as you know, is very similar to this, the staff did an impact statement, and they indicated that they expected minimal impact on the premium tax that accrues to the department. So based on that and the option of an if any policy, which would be purchased through a workers' comp carrier, that a lot of folks will avail themselves of, it doesn't appear that there is a huge impact. And I would sort of echo that based on my personal experience. Sort of the usage of owner-operators was much greater years ago than it is today, although they still are a prevalent part of the industry.
I'm sorry for another follow-up. I'm just trying to understand, is the impact of this going to be so that you will have a number of workers, number of drivers who, when they're injured, will no longer have coverage?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, no. I don't believe that to be the case. I believe that they will either have an if-any policy or they will have occupational accident insurance. So they will have coverage.
What was the first phrase you used, a what policy?
If any.
I don't know what that means.
Which is sort of a different version of workers' comp as I understand it. One of the explanations that I was given, this is not my area of expertise, was that owner-operators often buy if-any policies, particularly when they're operating in multiple states, because each state, as you know, has different workers' compensation laws. Mm-hmm. Some owner-operators will hire loading assistants, lumpers we call them, in various states, and those if-any policies will cover them if their lumper is injured while they're assisting the owner-operator.
I see. Just one more, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Sorry, I keep saying that. Do owner-operators carry, they carry insurance for their vehicle, I assume. Does that insurance include personal injury protection coverage?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, these are independent business men.
Right.
They are absolutely they're absolutely required to have insurance on their vehicle.
I know. I just don't know. I don't know that the law is well enough to know whether there's an exception for independent operators for trucks. For example, taxi drivers don't have PIP. I'll tell you that much.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that same chapter of law, 825, okay, has the insurance requirements, and I don't recall off the top of my head that there is any exclusion in that chapter for personal injury.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Russell, thank you. There's no one else that's signed up for Senate Bill 433, but is there anyone else here today that would want to give testimony? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on SB 433. And I don't know, is there comfort to go forward, or do we need more time?
If you could just a little more time.
Okay.
Time. I just want to...
So at this point, we're going to go ahead and move into the next public hearing. Next public hearing, we're calling Senate Bill 144. And Ms. Braun, you can get ready as we call up Mr. Commissioner Gardner. Annette Talbot and company, Christine Hammond.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 144 allows commissioner to award up to 50% of the sums collected as penalties against an employer who willfully causes employees not to receive their rest break or meal periods.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 144. Current law requires that employers provide workers with a paid, uninterrupted 10-minute break for every 4 hours of work segment or major portion thereof of the work period. The rest period should be given in the middle of each segment whenever possible. It requires for half an hour unpaid, relieved of all duties, meal period for each worker in an 8-hour shift, no earlier than the third hour, no later than the fifth. There are a number of exceptions for the nature and circumstances exemption, which is outlined in the testimony for, you know, safety and health reasons or particular other qualifications. Those are only for about a one-day period, though, other than in agriculture, which allows for a longer than one-day period for nature and circumstances. This Senate bill, basically, the legislation's designed because what happens in some rare circumstances is that an employee may not receive, you know, their rest period, for instance, for a 10-minute period. We're allowed to levy a $1,000 civil penalty for each one of those violations. So basically, if you had a, you know, didn't get your meal period or your rest period in a day, you could be fined up to $3,000 per employee per day. We don't, as a matter of policy, impose those fines or penalties. Our general policy is to get the employer in compliance. The employer will send a demand letter out and try very hard to get that employer in compliance. We won't even start an investigation on that employer unless they have three complaints or three violations within a 1 year period. But in rare circumstances, there are employers who basically will ignore the law, ignore the existence of the possibility of a civil penalty. What we do in those cases is do start proceedings on imposing the civil penalty. However, that penalty only goes into the general fund of the state. Not one dime actually goes to the employee. What this bill would do is allow us to give up to 50% of, you know, that $1,000 actually to the employee who is the one who, you know, basically worked through that period of time but never got the time for their rest breaks. And it gives us that ability to allow the employee to have some of the penalty that we would impose in those rare, egregious circumstances. I don't know if Christy has anything to add or Annette.
No, I'm just happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Let me ask first if committee members have questions. I have some questions and I'll follow up. Commissioner, maybe Christy or Annette, whoever. In reviewing the bills, I guess first in your testimony, my understanding is that Boley waits until the third violation within what period of time before?
Within a one-year period of time, Mr. Chair. Basically what happens is we send out a demand letter stating to the employer, and there should be, I believe, attached to your testimony a copy of a demand letter. We'll send out to the employer telling them basically what the law is, how it works, how it operates, and try to get that employer into compliance.
Okay.
And we do exactly the same thing on the second. Since when you hit the third one within a one-year period, we'll actually start an investigation against that employer. It doesn't automatically mean that they would fall into a civil penalty situation. That just starts the trigger for the investigation. Now, if they still are violating, you know, there is a point you reach where you have to impose a civil penalty, unfortunately, to get their attention.
Okay. Next question regarding up to 50% of the fine going to the employee. Has the department looked at restitution for the loss versus a portion of the fine?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually we've talked to some attorneys who would like to go into court for some form of relief and restitution. Some of them have there is a theory that's never been tried in court. There's a couple of them that tried it on one particular case we're aware of, but actually the case got thrown out on technicality. The crux of the theory is that it's like having vacation time. You accrue vacation time. You have 2, 3, 4 weeks of vacation accrued, but the employer never allows you to actually take it. It's not a benefit if you're never allowed to actually be given the time off and paid for.
Let me rephrase that question because I don't know if I made it clear. Instead of saying that the employee could potentially get 50% of a fine that could be a maximum of $1,000 for one offense, has the department looked at what would the person be able to receive in the sense of actual hourly wages or whatever they lost, and impose what I would call a restitution from the department level versus a portion of the fine?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, they haven't lost any wages. The 10 minutes is a paid time frame. If you didn't get the 10 minutes off, you still got to pay for it. You just didn't get the 10 minutes. The lunch break is 30 minutes unpaid, so you actually didn't, you know, if you're made to work through it, you're paid for that time frame. If you're not paid for a time frame, there are other penalties and other things that come into play. For instance, if you tried to work through your 30 minutes of lunch period, not paid, we have other restitution for that. That's failure to pay wages.
Okay. Two other questions. One, you pretty well, I guess, at least got us started on how the allegations handled and proven. From what I understand, as a starting point, it's the third one before you actually take action. You've got two letters that go out. The third one is where an investigation begins. Can you walk us through, at that point, what in a normal case would transpire?
Okay. Chair Posonsky, normally what we're trying to do is at that point determine why we're continuing to get complaints from employees. So we would contact the employer and say, this is the third time we've gotten a complaint. Do you have a policy of providing rest and meal periods? And determine whether or not the employer is telling employees not to take rest and meal periods or why we're continuing to get complaints. It's pretty rare that we have an employer that flat out deliberately does not comply with the law. Usually it's a matter of educating them, but we have had a few instances where employees continue to tell us the employer is telling us not to take our rest and meal periods, and that's when we start looking at some penalties.
Okay. And the last question I had was, does the Bureau have any guesstimation as to how much money we're discussing as to the impact ramifications of these type of violations?
Chair Posonsky, we've only assessed civil penalties 5 times over the last several years. The last penalty we assessed was in 2002, and that was for $10,000. That was one of the higher penalties. Normally, we also assessed a penalty of $5,000 in 2000 and penalties of $12,500 and $24,000 in 2 other cases. Depends on the number of workers that have not been receiving their rest and meal periods. So that would really dictate the amount of civil penalty that we assessed.
I understand that, and also understand that how many you've done in the last 5 years. Could you tell us, just for the record, how many other instances you've had that you actually gained compliance without assessing a fine during that same period of time?
Well, Chair Posonsky, right now we just send the letters, so we don't follow up again until we've gotten a third complaint. We did send approximately 300 letters to employers as a result of complaints received last year. So I guess we assume that if we don't continue to get complaints, we assume that we've achieved compliance in those cases.
So would it be fair to assess if you did 300 last year over a 5-year period, it would be approximately 1,500 letters that would have been sent out?
I think that would be.
And out of that resulted only in 5 fines being imposed in that 5-year period. I'm just trying to get some balance.
No, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay. Any questions at this point?
Christine Hammond, Administrator of the Wage and Hour Division.
You just need to share it.
Okay. All right.
Details.
All right. Thank you all very much. I want you to step back. We've got 2 other people that are scheduled this time who want to testify. Don Schellenberg and John McCulley, if you both would come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schellenberg representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Chair, members of the committee, the Farm Bureau is opposed to Senate Bill 144 and the principle included in the proposed change to ORS 653256. It's been the understanding of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, BOLI, we'll refer to them as BOLI hereafter, since the adoption of ORS 653.261 sub 2, that meal and rest period provisions authorized by administrative rule are not applicable to agriculture employees or employers. It was not. It, 2 years ago, however, with amendments to OAR 839-020-0050, BOLI turned that understanding on its head. It has long been understood that agriculture employment is unique as compared to other employment because in addition to being a perishable commodity, there are narrow windows of time determined by the weather in which planting, cultivating, pruning, and harvesting must occur. If the producer misses that window, the entire year's production and income may be lost. Because agriculture producers do not generally have the ability to pass on increased production costs, it is also a long-held practice that much of the work is done on a piece rate basis. And I would stop here to say that even though it's on a piece rate basis, we're still required to meet the minimum wage for the employees. Producers identify the per unit price they will receive for their product, calculate all of the production costs on a per unit basis, and the profit necessary to remain a producer of the commodity. What remains is the amount available for the cost of labor. That amount becomes the per unit rate available for the worker. And that's the only variable cost that we actually have, that we have any control of all, is the wages. The principle of the piece rate wage is that workers can work at a speed and for a length of time that is comfortable for them. They may take long or short rest periods when it suits them, and they may take a lunch period when and forever, for however long they want. While the worker enjoys the flexible work time and may earn wages double or more than that of the minimum wage, piece rate workers do understand that when they are not working, they are not earning money. That is what makes the application of defined meal and rest periods for agricultural workers difficult to administer on the farm. Because of the law, the employer may be penalized when the employer resists the employer's instruction to obey the law because the employee wants to earn the maximum amount of wages while the opportunity is there. And I apologize for the length of the explanation on the piece rate, but it's important to understand why application of meal and rest period rules have not historically been applied to agriculture. While this hearing and Senate Bill 144 are not about sustaining or rescinding the meal and rest periods rules, I must tell you that application of the current meal and rest period rules and now a proposal such as this is the reason producers are turning to crops that do not use intensive labor. In the end, Oregon is discouraging agricultural producers, reducing the employment opportunities for farm workers, and hurting Oregon's economy. The Farm Bureau recommends that you reject Senate Bill 144. Thank you, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Schellenberg. Questions for Mr. Schellenberg at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I don't understand why this bill is a problem. I think your problem is that the rest periods and lunch break have been applied to agricultural workers, but this really just says where the fines go. I don't understand how your testimony relates to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick. The concern and the principle involved here is the concern that it provides an incentive for workers to possibly cause a problem for the employer. There's an incentive for them to allege, at least, that they did not take a break, or that they were not given time to take a break, or that they were not given a meal period. And at that point, then the employee has to defend that, and may have been totally within the law. But they still have to defend that. But because the employee is given some of the penalty, there is now an incentive for them to, in effect, become an enforcement agent for the Bureau. That's our concern.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, I think that, that I can understand. Okay, right. Thank you.
And Mr. Sellenberg, I guess I've got a couple of questions. What I heard from your testimony is that first, the rule that is in place now has been in place for 2 years, so the farm workers have already are covered under the interpretation. Do you know if there's been reports from the farm workers to Boley as to them being denied one of their breaks? I mean, I'm wondering if you know from any of your members whether there have been these type of claims that you're concerned that might come about.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not aware of those. Our employers have not indicated to me that there have been any problems. We had never heard of this before 2 years ago, and we were quite surprised at that point that there was the administrative rule that now brought agriculture workers under this provision, since there hadn't been a problem. I'm still not aware that there is a problem.
Okay.
But again, our concern here is that this may lead to creating problems because there is now some financial incentive.
Okay. At some point, I'm going to ask the commissioner to come back to address a couple of your concerns. But I'm going to go ahead and put the question out there so you can give us your response as well. From your testimony, if you have an individual worker who's working piecemeal, if they're not working at a given period of time in the morning and they're off, let's say they're not picking for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, wouldn't you believe that that would actually not accommodate but would fit the requirement that they have a break during the morning time so the farmer wouldn't be obligated to give them additional time off if they're actually idled during that morning work period?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the concern, and I hate, you know, don't want to get into the meal and rest period issue per se, but the issue is there's defined times now when they are required to take these breaks, rest periods. Oftentimes they come to work early. They take a break maybe for the restroom or a snack or something whenever they feel like taking it.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not like to be bound by that. I've talked to our employers. I mean, the thing we have talked about, and they've told me, is we can't get them to quit. They don't want to stop.
Right.
And yet we're forced to try to make them stop, and that doesn't set real well with them. And on top of that, we have to be able to somehow verify that, in fact, they did take their break or their lunch period at the appropriate time. And when you got several hundred workers in the field, and maybe they're in different fields, it becomes near impossible to document that thing so the user and employer are protected against the penalty.
Okay. I appreciate your answers. Are there any other questions at this point? Mr. McCulloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit growers. These are primarily cherry, pear, and apple growers in the Hood River, the Dalles area of southern Oregon, and in the Milton Freewater area in the northeastern part of the state. We, too, are opposed to Senate Bill 144 for many of the same reasons that Mr. Schellenberg has already described to you. I've talked with some of the people that I represent, and this is a huge management challenge for them to enforce the meal and rest break period, as Mr. Schellenberg has described. I've had one grower talk to me about the efforts they have made to actually go out in the fields and force the workers off the ladders, the picking ladders, because they don't want to take the meal and a rest break. And from a management standpoint, they try to have it done all at the same time. So this 10-minute break will occur at a specific time. They may blow an air horn. They do other things to try to get compliance, but they all try to do it at the same time. And what we see as the problem with this bill is, as Mr. Schellenberg has explained, is an incentive to violate that meal and rest break period because of the now potential for getting some money for not taking the break that the employer is trying to force them to take. We just see it as adding another risk to the business that already has a lot of risks associated with it, and we don't think it's a good public policy to pursue.
Okay. Questions, Mr. McCauley?
Mr. McCauley, I do want to follow up on the two questions I asked Mr. Schellenberg and ask if you had any response. I'm going to actually ask that either the commissioner or one of his assistants come back. There are two things I'm going to be asking them. One is that my understanding in some other bills that we had that there is an obligation in normal work cycles to provide for a lunch period between the third and fifth hour, as well as whether there's actually an obligation on the part of the employee to take a break, even if they choose not to, let's say in a piecemeal. So I'm going to ask them for clarification. I guess what I'd like to know is that if the department says there's no obligation on the employer to force the employer to have the employee take these breaks, do you think your members would have as much concern with the bills if it's a if it's piecemeal work and the employee, I mean, the way I look at it, the employee says, I don't want to take my 10-minute break. I want to keep on working. You know, blow off lunch. I'm going to make more money, and I can do that. I mean, a lot of us have different eating habits and stuff like that. If it's clear and demonstrated that the employer cannot be held liable or accountable for that, do you think your members would have a different position on the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's certainly something we could talk to them about. It's been our understanding that that is not an option, that the employee has to take the break even if they don't want to. And that's why, as I said, I've had one grower tell me they had to actually go out in the field and force people to get off the ladders to take the break.
And I appreciate the position that your members are in. So if you're finished with no other comments, or Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have the same concerns that these two witnesses have, and I don't think that issue alone, I guess if the commissioner says that they don't have to take the break, if that still does not remove the incentive that this bill gives the employee to go file complaints to try to get a windfall of money. And that's the concern I have as a lawmaker and as a employer,
right,
is that, you know, they just, whether or not, you know, it can be proven or not, you're put in a position you've got to defend yourself. And you've got to be able to show records that, yes, on every single day, if this employee says he or she wasn't given a break, you, in fact, did blow the air horn or did something to, you have documented proof you actually gave them an opportunity to take that break. And without this bill, there is no financial incentive for the employee to make those complaints. Maybe, you know, if someone's being abused, they should, you know, there should be a complaint made. But this gives them a financial incentive.
I understand that they could potentially benefit from this as the bill is currently drafted, but that also the employer could still be facing the same type of allegations from a worker at this point. And what we know from the testimony at this point is that these bills or this law has been interpreted by rule for the last 2 years, and at this point we don't know of a case that's come before Bowley on these facts. So I guess I'm inclined to have the commissioner and one or both of his assistants to come back up and put on the record exactly what obligations an employer actually has.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, Farm Bureau. If I can make one other comment.
Please.
The piece rate issue is the particular problem. Mm-hmm. Those who have hourly employees, I'm told that they don't have, they had to get them used to taking it at the particular time, even though they were hourly, but they have not had as much trouble getting the hourly employees to take their break at the appropriate time, obviously, because they're being paid. They aren't losing any money when they take their rest period.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Commissioner, if you'll please come back up. I'm going to go over these three. I got actually three questions now.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, let me go ahead and clarify a few things. First of all, let me correct Mr. Schellenberg. That rule has only been in effect for 1 year, not two. It went into effect February the 1st of last year. Basically, what it did was came out of testimony. There was a hearing in the Senate committee on Senator Avell Gordley's bill. We also held hearings within Woodburn on the potential of my changing the administrative rule. At that time, nor at any time since, has one single agricultural worker ever
told me, sent me a letter, had one phone call that they didn't want meals or rest periods. I have heard this continued argument. I have yet to meet one farm worker who feels that way, though. A couple of other things is that one of the things they do that we've talked about, we set up an agricultural advisory committee after last legislative session and discussed the, you know, the potential of changing this administrative rule. Two things were done within that agricultural committee in order to address the issue. One is, if you look into the law, into the nature and circumstances, which we also showed you in the testimony earlier, there is another additional exception for agriculture that came out of that committee, where it notes that under additional factors specified in the agriculture industry may also prevent an employee from receiving a meal or rest period in which they are completely relieved of all duties. Costs involved in shutting down or starting up power-driven equipment during a continuous harvest operation is an exception. Emergencies created by acts of nature, including imminent and adverse weather conditions that are likely in the result of significant and substantial economic injury or reduced revenue from production, yields of quality losses in harvest or planting is prevented, unforeseen conditions that will pose a serious risk to the crop failure, and health and safety of employees, public or others, in contact with crops or pesticide application of crops. Also, we noted that these factors may also prevent employers from establishing or maintaining regularly scheduled rest or meal periods. However, employees must always receive rest breaks in essence, although it doesn't say in here, so one may be able to use the restroom. We also allow within this rule two consecutive calendar days, which we don't allow in any other aspect of employment anywhere other than in agriculture. That came out of those. Also, what happens is in agriculture, and I've actually toured different agricultural facilities and seen this happen, is that they go through an intake process where each and every agricultural worker is given, you know, the pesticide education as they're taken in intake and a number of other things they train them on as well. At that, we have actually created a bilingual brochure on meals and rest periods where it's available, and we ask farm contractors to provide that brochure to them so employees know what the law is as well. There is actually no defined time other than is, for agriculture workers any different than any other worker in the state. So in other words, during a four-hour period for an adult, you're allowed 10 minutes, for a minor, 15 minutes paid. Generally, within the middle of that four-hour period, the same is true for your lunch break. If you're on an eight-hour shift, for instance, you get 30 minutes unbroken, unpaid, relieved of all duties, no earlier than the third hour, no later than the fifth. Agriculture workers fall under the same thing since that change in definition. They are correct, Mr. Chair, in saying that it is the obligation of an employer to document those breaks were taken. That's true in all law, in all forms. No one sets a requirement, however, that you have to blow a whistle and have it, a rest period at 10 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Or if you've got 500 or 600 workers working in three different fields that all have to take the lunch break at the same time, quite frankly, in agriculture, it makes absolutely no sense to do so, because you couldn't provide enough restrooms for them when you blow the whistle at 10 o'clock for a 10-minute rest period. Or could you have enough lunch wagons or other things there, you know, for a vast number? It makes sense to do it in a staggered fashion. But those decisions are up to the employer about when they take them within the definitions of law. Yeah. I don't know if I answered all your questions in that long explanation. But
you haven't, so I'm going to go over a couple of them.
So if you have a situation where a farm worker is working piecemeal, what I'm hearing is that the farmer has an obligation to stop that person from working for a 10-minute break during the first 4 hours, and during the third and fifth hour, requiring them to take a break to eat. And the same thing about the 10 or 15-minute break, depending on their age, in the evening or in the afternoon.
They have an obligation to educate the employee that that is their right under the law. An employee who doesn't want to take the break, if one exists, I have not yet met one, but if they exist, they're not the person that's going to complain. if they don't want to take a break, they're not going to send a complaint to us. And one other thing is, as I told you last week, there were only two complaints in agriculture I was aware of. Actually, we checked the records, and there have been seven. All of them have been sent a letter just explaining what the law is, a demand letter just like we gave you and as an exhibit, and there have been no repeat problems. We actually did, with the Ag Advisory Committee at the end of the harvest season, sit down and have a discussion about the meal and rest period and how it's working, and no one seemed to know of any serious problems or serious complaints that other than those seven. And we found about 26 violations out there while we were doing investigations through the Farm Labor Unit, and seven complaints. But those were all taken care of through demand letters and educating the employer.
Okay. Let me ask you, in the sense of a defense of a employer, in this case a farmer,
mm-hmm.
who has people working, I want to say on a piecemeal basis, because it doesn't seem like it's a problem if it's not piecemeal. If part of the education and informing that employee, if they provided them with some type of waiver or some type of knowledge, something that they would sign, that would be in their native language, so they, you know, make sure everyone understands it, and they actually laid out that you have these rights, and if they signed it and said that they choose to waive those rights, would that be something that the Bureau would actually take in consideration if there was an allegation filed against them later?
Mr. Chair, there was some discussion about that with the Ag Advisory Committee when we initially set up this particular change in administrative rule. There are a couple of states that do allow that. However, in conversation with some of those states and talking about with compliance officials on that, the deep concern came of the ability for coercion for the employee to sign it. If the employee had the availability of signing it but rejecting it at any moment in time, but the employers didn't like the idea of the ability for rejection, they wanted someone to be able to sign it and it was good throughout their employment. So we went back and forth in discussing it and basically dropped that idea.
Okay, and the last question, I guess this is more of a statement, maybe get a response. It does seem to me that once you put in a potential incentive for someone to receive monetary gain, that there could be a reasonable concern on the part of the employer that if they don't have some way of protecting themselves on these piecemeal workers, that they could in fact see themselves having allegations filed.
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would say is simply explain how we do it, you know, as I did earlier with our process. This bill only allows for the discretion to give up to 50%. It's not mandatory in any way, shape, or form. And the only instance I could ever see it being done is with an employer who absolutely violates the law repeatedly and has a pattern and practice of abuse.
Okay.
Is how we would use the discretion allowed within this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions based on mine or any others that might have come up? Right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So is there anyone else here who would like to testify today on Senate Bill 144? Not seeing anyone. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 144, and that's going to take us to our third bill, which will be opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 434. And Marcia Holmiller?
That's correct.
Okay, please come up and comment.
Senate Bill 434 provides authority to the Bureau of Labor and Industries for enforcement of investigative subpoenas. And on your desk there is a letter from the City of Portland expressing concerns about the bill. We received this letter today. You all have that letter.
I've got one.
The letter basically talks about parameters they'd like to have written in the bill.
And is there anyone from the city here today?
No, they weren't able to make it.
Okay. Please go ahead and state your name and give us your testimony.
My name is Marcia Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to speak to Senate Bill 434. The Bureau already has the authority to issue investigative subpoenas, and that is a long-standing authority. investigative subpoenas are distinguishable from the kind of subpoenas we would issue for a contested case hearing. That's from a separate part of the ORS, but we also have the ability to issue investigative subpoenas. Because our general way of administering these is that we first seek the cooperation of respondents by asking them to voluntarily provide evidence in the cases that we're investigating, most of the time, a very high percentage of the time, almost always, respondents do provide the documentary evidence and the talk to us or allow us to talk to the necessary persons to investigate cases. However, in a recent case, it came to our attention, because it is so rare that we go through all this and don't ultimately get what we need without having to enforce our subpoena authority, we discovered that there is no explicit statutory authority for us to go to a circuit court and ask them to enforce an investigative subpoena, as exists for a number of other regulatory agencies. The authority is there for a court to enforce our subpoenas. However, the Attorney General who was working on it for us said the only way that he could determine was to go to the court and actually file a lawsuit against the respondent who was declining to cooperate with us. And that's the first time it really came to our attention that the tools were simply not spelled out in the statute. Obviously, filing a lawsuit against a party is a pretty drastic measure when what you really want is just their cooperation with an agency subpoena. And so at that point, we determined that we would like to have that spelled out in the statute, which is the bill that you have before you, which simply would say that in cases where a party was not complying with a subpoena or was refusing to answer questions from the Bureau, that a court would have the authority to do a contempt proceeding to enforce the subpoena. And it was mentioned already that the City of Portland did submit a letter for your consideration expressing some concerns, and they're not here today. I did speak with Stephanie Harper, who is the author of that letter, about it and talked about the background of our bill and what we were seeking to do. And they, in her letter, she mentions a case where they received a subpoena from our Civil Rights Division. They thought it was overly broad, but as they acknowledge in their letter, it was ultimately worked out, and there was no need for us to go to court to enforce the subpoena. But what I clarified with Ms. Harper is we're not establishing any new authority here. We're simply trying to get something in the law for courts to have the authority to do this more simplified and expedited proceeding for subpoena enforcement rather than the time-consuming, expensive, and overly complicated method of using a lawsuit. So I also discussed with her the fact that we do have internal procedures, and in your packet there, there should be three pieces. One would be my testimony, and then there's an addendum that talks about the City of Portland letter, and then there's also a handout that says Wage and Hour Division subpoena procedure. Do you all have that? And I think if you look through that, you'll see that this is one division's approach to making sure that its compliance people understand the proper procedures for issuing agency subpoenas and giving a reasonable amount of time for response and that sort of thing. I think after I spoke with Ms. Harper, what I explained was, you know, rather than have it spelled out in the statute what these reasonable procedures would be, we would prefer to have it in internal policy, because there are circumstances where we might need to seek quite expedited compliance with a subpoena. For instance, in a situation where you had workers in danger, we have actually had circumstances where people were on a fire line in a forest fire, and we had allegations that they were not properly trained or that they didn't even have legal ID on them. In that kind of a circumstance, we don't want to be encumbered by statutory language that says we will give them 5 days to comply, for instance, or that type of thing. What's important to know is that in linking the bill, where the bill links the statute to circuit court contempt proceedings, all of the circuit court contempt proceedings law follows. So the court would have the same authorities, as far as we understand it from speaking with legislative counsel, the court would have the same authorities to look at what it is we're asking and whether it's reasonable and whether it's relevant, and all those kinds of things would follow. There's also a specific body of law about enforcement of agency subpoenas that does talk about what is required, what kind of showing would be required. So it's not simply the language wouldn't just direct a court to tell them to obey the subpoena or else. The court could certainly, and we would hope they would, hold us accountable for any showing necessary that the subpoena was legal and appropriate in all respects. So essentially, I think that's an overview of what the bill would do. When you look at the language of it, it would put this language into a number of different places in the statutes. And the reason for that is the existing subpoena authority, issuance authority of the Bureau is found in several different places. So you want this language in all of those places. And the origin of the language that Ledge Council used is very similar to language that's in the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, talking about how to enforce a subpoena for a contested case hearing. So that was the model they were going on for the specific language.
Ms. Oldmiller, just to make sure I understood that, it's your understanding that the framework that's used in Senate Bill 434 for enforcement is the same that is used for an administrative law proceeding?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
I think that completes my overview of the bill. If there are questions, I'm happy to speak to them.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. First, the example you cited in the case of firefighters not having adequate training, isn't that an OSHA issue? Do you regulate firefighters and train firefighters?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we do. The Bureau has jurisdiction over forest labor contract licensing, and in that licensing authority are certain criteria, some of which involve worker safety. It is true that there is also worker safety jurisdiction with OSHA. However, we also have a piece of that with forest contractor licensing.
Okay, another question on a different issue, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. You say the bill doesn't give you any new authority, but what you didn't, at least I didn't hear you say, is that the bill greatly expands the chapters of law that you would give you a subpoena authority for. Currently, you have discrete authority in Chapter 652 and 653 and 658, and no authority at all in Chapter 659, and this bill brings in all of Chapters 652, 653, 658, and 659.
We do have subpoena authority over those chapters. If you look at, in the first section of the bill, it lists out specific parts, for instance, of Chapter 658, and it would delete that language and simply put Chapter 658.
Exactly.
It's not adding any new parts of Chapter 658 other than what we already have jurisdiction over and what we would already have subpoena issuance jurisdiction over. The intent in the drafting of this bill was not to grant us any new subpoena issuance authority.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the intent, but the bill clearly expands that authority, because it brings in a whole new chapter that currently isn't listed, and it also, under 652, 653, and 658, it specifically has areas you do have authority, and this bill grants blanket authority to all of those chapters.
Right. No, I read that too. I'm not sure what each of those new statutes that are within, let's say, 652 or 658 include as to whether it really gives them more authority. It definitely says that it applies to the full chapter, that's for sure. And 659A is not listed, at least in my quick review, under the existing language that would be stricken and replaced with. So
Mr. Chair, I might.
Help.
Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. If you take a look at what is now Section 5 of the bill, which is 659-800, and on the very top of page 4, it does say that the commissioner or the designee of the commissioner may issue subpoenas to require the production of evidence under that chapter, which is 659. So that currently does exist in our civil rights chapter. The legislative council often take license in terms of rearranging things when they're doing these kinds of bills in a housekeeping manner. So we do have Chapter 659A authority for our Civil Rights Division now for subpoenas.
Okay. Do you have another question, Mr. Chair?
You may.
Chapter 2 of the bill, or excuse me, Section 2 of the bill, is a rewrite of Section 1 with the exception that it was amended by Chapter or Section 305, Chapter 794, Oregon Law 2003. I'm curious to know what we did in 2003 to amend that section and why we still have a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the what's alluded to there is amendments that will become operative on March 1st of 2005 for public contracts first advertised on or after that date. And if you look, if you had the ORS chapter in front of you, there would be ORS 651060 in big letters, and then down below in small letters it would have the chapter or the section repeated with language saying that the following language becomes operative after March 1st of 2005, and that is a creature of legislative drafting. I looked at that too, and that's what that is. It's necessary to repeat that whole section.
Yeah, but it's a dealing with public contracting, you said?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, you'll actually may be seeing a bill over this side. Last session there was a rewrite, House Bill 2341 or 14, and it totally rewrote the public contracting laws to segregate them out into 279A, B, and C to try and deal with public contracting related to construction, public contracting related to personal services. So it was a non-substantive sort of rewrite of all those public contracting laws, which is what Ms. Ola Miller was referring to.
Am I supposed to be?
Yes. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Burdick.
You're done. Are you done with
yes,
your
question?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I wanted to ask you on the City of Portland letter on page 2. That first full paragraph at the top, they talked about their concerns about feeling they had an obligation to respond to questions even if they might not have known the answer. And I'm just wondering if you read the authority that way and if there's some way you can work with the City of Portland to put some sideboards on this issue so that at least that concern would be resolved.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I did speak with Legislative Council about the language that the City of Portland was concerned about. Specifically, when you look at the bill, it says if a person fails to obey a subpoena or to answer questions. And Legislative Council indicated that they considered the answer questions to be to follow logically on the subpoena power. And in fact, since they were modeling this language after the contested case subpoena authority, it speaks in that statute of responding or answering questions of the agency as well as responding to a subpoena for documents. So they weren't intending to, I see it sounds like it's different from the subpoena authority, but the way it was explained to me, it's consistent with the subpoena authority that we can ask parties to answer questions. If you look at the packet of wage and hour materials, they actually in their procedures do have, they separate out, you know, asking for documents from subpoenaing someone as a witness to come in and talk to them about something. So it is two pieces of the same type of authority. And in fact, if in fact someone didn't want to talk to us, we would see it in the same way as not responding to a subpoena. If we did end up taking it to court, which would be extremely rare, the court would scrutinize what we were doing with respect to the questions, whether they were relevant. So I think after I spoke with the city's representative, I think that we did come to an understanding that we're not talking about if I call her on the phone and she doesn't answer a question or answer it to my satisfaction, that Boley is off to court against her personally or something like that. What we're talking about is answering questions within the parameters of an investigation that are relevant to that investigation.
Because I think she's making the point, if I can follow up, Mr. Chairman, right, that typically an agency is granted the authority to subpoena witnesses to testify and respond to questions under oath. But she was kind of making the point that she was worried that if someone didn't know the answer to a question, it couldn't respond because of that. And I'm just wondering if there's some way this could be clarified on the face of it to resolve that concern, or whether she was satisfied. I think, Mr. Chairman, it might just be that we have to wait and see if she is satisfied with that.
One of the things we could do is we could ask counsel to maybe make contact with Ms. Harper. It sounds like there's been a conversation that's taken place maybe prior to us getting this letter, or since we got the letter, mm-hmm, and just get some clarification.
Yeah, that would be great.
Any other questions? Any other comments from you?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, we'd be glad to work with the city. It is an awkward wording, but that is what we were recommended by legislative council. So if we can allay their fears by changing the wording to something that council will agree obtains the same results, we'd be more than happy to do that.
All right. Thank you.
And it does sound like you've worked cooperatively, you know, with them, which I think probably helps the situation a lot.
And anything else?
No.
Is there any other individuals who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 434? If not, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 434. And at this time, open the public hearing on House Bill 2153.
House Bill,
our first one, if I'm not mistaken. Floyd Lanter. Mr. Lanter, please come forward. If I'd known you were in the room with a name like that, we'd let you go first.
But we would call you pretty boy like we do here.
We have to take care of each other. Ms. Lanter, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I didn't realize I could clear a room this quick, but I'm here today to request the committee support for House Bill 2153. This legislative proposal provides for a technical adjustment to Chapter 86, Section 245, which requires lenders to pay interest on escrow impounds, those funds that lenders require real estate borrowers to pay into the account to cover property taxes and fire insurance and the like. The language of the current law ties the interest rate to be paid to the 13-week or 3-month U.S. Treasury bill average auction rate as quoted in the Federal Reserve Statistical Release H-15. However, the Federal Reserve's Statistical Release H-15 stopped listing the average auction rate in July of 2000. For this reason, proposed changes to the statute substitute the average auction rate as published by the U.S. Treasury Bureau of Public Debt. The other proposed change is a reordering of the language in the statute, so it's a little bit easier to read. The proposed language starts with a definitional section and then addresses the payment of interest on escrow impounds on a rate based upon the average auction rate. The language is identical to the language in the current law, simply reorganized. The proposed changes in the statute are technical or housekeeping in nature, and they do not impact revenues or expenditures. I would respectfully request the committee support for the bill and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Ms. Lanter, thank you. Since I've already lost my 100% by not allowing my amendment.
Oh, that's because of the House bill.
Being the House bill. Did you track this bill at all as to, I mean, the vote looks like it came out of the House Committee at 7-0.
Right, it was a unanimous vote.
And then it cleared the House. The House didn't have much opposition on the floor either.
It was on the consent calendar.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the record for us?
No, I think the record is fine.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Lanter? Thank you very much. And we'll go. Mr. Martinez, did you want to speak? Doesn't look like anyone else is in the room, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2153. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill
2153.
And is there any discussion to the motion? If not, anyone opposed to moving the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Not seeing any, we'll go to the floor with a due pass recommendation, House Bill 2153, and would one of you two like to be the carrier?
I will carry it, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Senator Burdick will be our carrier, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2153. And, Anna, do we have anything else that we need to share? I want to just go over the change in date for the our other meeting, but is there anything else that we had to share?
Not at this time.
We've been told by the President's office that our meeting that was scheduled for April 22nd is going to be moved up 1 week. It's going to be on the Thursday prior to that, and I don't have the date in front of me.
It's April 15th. Actually, they're still thinking we're going on a Friday.
Right.
It's on April 22nd, so it's the Friday before April 15th.
It'll be the 15th.
Tax day.
So that's kind of what we're looking at. Apparently, the April 22nd is going to be some school's day or something like that. They want us to be participating in, and so they're asking, or they have given us notice through committee staff that we may have a change. So if you could just put on your calendars that it appears that we may be going the week before what we had been told, and we'll still coordinate.
Your staff.
Okay.
Notice,
all right. Just for everyone that's listening who's wanting to follow us out on the road, there's your notice. With that said, I'll go ahead and close the Senate Commerce Committee for today. And thank you.